Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Harriet Minter, and you're listening to the Badass Women's Hour. On this week's show, it's a slightly different format, partly because there were two things that I really wanted to talk about and had amazing guests to talk with, so I thought I'd share them with you, because it's a bank holiday weekend and I did promise myself that I would try and minimise all work on a bank holiday, and partly because the building site next to my flat has decided today is the day to really go for it on the drilling. And that just doesn't make the best podcast background. So instead, you've got two interviews from my weekly radio show on Talk Radio. The first is with Vonda Vypertska, and it is about the race report. So you probably saw this published last week, the government's inquiry into race relations in the UK that has been pretty roundly panned because, well, it's conducted for a start by a man who thinks that slavery was an excellent opportunity for Africa. Never one of the best people, I think, to conduct a race report. Anyway, I talked to Vonda, who is the CEO of the Equalities Trust, all about why the report is flawed and what we can do to challenge it. And then I meet an absolutely incredible woman. Hella Pick is 96. She's been a journalist for nearly 50 years, or more than 50 years. She's been a journalist for more than 50 years. And her reporting basically took us all the way through the Cold War. She was one of the first female foreign correspondents. She reported on the death of JFK, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and many other moments from history. She's met incredible people and lived an amazing life. And her story is just fascinating. So I'm really excited to be able to bring her to the show. But first up, let's hear from Vonda.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
Hi, Vonda.
Hi, it's Vonda here. Nice to be here. Vonda,
thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell me, when you read the report, what was your reaction to it?
Well, I think my reaction to the report started before I read it. And, you know, I'm on record, as many people are, as expressing our extreme disappointment that the commission was being chaired by Tony Sewell. So we sort of knew what was coming from that announcement. But I honestly think that, you know, we have been massively shocked, even considering that he was appointed chair. I mean, when we look at things like, you know, statements such as slavery was an opportunity to remodel Africans into Britons. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm descended from slaves. Yeah. Doing my ancestry DNA, you know, I found that most of my DNA came from West Africa, and my ancestors were shipped over to the Caribbean and were slaves. So, you know, to hear these sorts of things in the 21st century, that slavery was a great opportunity, you know, I think it's just appalling. And that's just one of the many, many things that are wrong with this report.
One of the things that really struck me about the report is it feels like almost the hiding behind the phrase ethnic minorities. Right.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems. I mean, actually, one of the few things I do agree with the report on, and, you know, believe me, there aren't many, is that we must stop using this term BAME.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if we use the term Black, Asian and ethnic minorities, then, you know, I'm part Polish. I'm an ethnic minority in terms of being Polish. I'm an ethnic minority in terms of being Caribbean. But I mean, what we're doing is basically saying, if you're white, this is the default, and everybody else goes into the same categories. And, you know, there are very different educational and life outcomes for children who are Chinese, for children who are Black African, for children who are Black Caribbean, for children who are mixed, you know, for children who are Gypsy Romas or travellers. Yeah. And so by putting everyone together, it really just says, you know, here's a bunch of people and they're not white, so let's just put them all in one category.
Yeah. Doreen Lawrence said this week that she feels this report has put race relations in the UK back by about 20 years. What do you think about that?
Well, I think she's been quite generous, actually. Mm. I think this, you know, has really, really undone a lot of the work that many of us have been doing, you know, for decades. And for Doreen to say that, it must be so heartbreaking for her after everything she's been through, you know, to see this and the countless other mothers of children that have been killed because of racism. And for all of our communities, you know, there's a... We've had report after report after report and no action. And now I think our fear is that action will be taken, but it will be on the basis of this report. And that's an absolute, not just a lost opportunity, but it's so divisive and so harmful.
What action do you think might be taken on the basis of this?
Well, I think what we're seeing already is government ministers waiving this report and saying, mm-hmm. you know, look, there's no such thing as structural racism, so it's fine. We live in a fantastic country and we're a beacon. You know, it's part of this obsession, yeah. isn't it, of us being yeah. the best in the world at everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean...
it's a very strange mentality, yeah.
You know, if we had friends saying they were the best at everything all the time, I think yeah. we'd pretty well stop seeing them, wouldn't we? So, you know, it is part of this very sort of nationalistic effort. And it's, but more importantly, what is very clear is that it's part of the government's sort of rhetoric about trying to split working class people who, you know, are going through a terrible time at the moment mm-hmm. with furlough, with a whole range of things, with COVID hitting the most deprived communities. And on top of it all, you know, this report is being used to try and divide people so that we see each other as enemies rather than, you know, working together and being together. It's really, really obvious what's happening with this. But what's important is that what they're trying to do is say that this is all about the individual. It's not yes. about structural inequality. Mm-hmm. It's not about a collective and a system. It's just about individual problems. So, you know, we'll just deal with this on an individual level.
I mean, one of the things that really struck me was there's a point in the report where they say something along the lines of, you know, you don't help yourself. If you feel that you are going to be, if you feel the deck is stacked against you, then that's really part of the problem. I mean, I as a white woman was ashamed, actually, that anyone would have thought that was acceptable or useful commentary in 2021.
Well, absolutely. And as many of the academics have said, you know, this flimsy report flies in the face of decades of yeah. peer-reviewed scientific research. And I think, Harriet, you know, if you flip it for a minute and if you put women yeah. In this rather than black mm-hmm. people and, you know, or BAME, as they want to call it, everyone who's yeah. not white, and you replace that with women, you know, we can see the structural sexism. We can see yeah. the gender pay gap. We can see, you know, out of the FTSE 100, I think there's five or maybe mm-hmm. six women who lead companies. You know, we can see all of this. I mean, our economic, our political and our legal systems were created a couple of hundred years ago when only the very top privileged men, and they were white men, could hold any power. And so, you know, we are still in these systems that are really, really stacked against anyone who really isn't, you know, a sort of white upper class man.
Mm. We saw David Lammy this week say that actually he just wasn't going to comment on this. Don't, you know, if you're the media, don't ask me to come and comment on this. I've had enough, essentially. Is that, do you think, how the black community feels right now?
I think many of us do. And I think, you know, we're torn between the fact that we have to get out there yeah. and, you know, talk about this and point it out for what it is. But, you know, we are tired of having to justify the things that happen to us every day. You know, yeah. the racism that we encounter, and not just overt racism, but, you know, yeah. racism's in the system, the lack of promotion, the fact that, you know, mm-hmm. disproportionately black workers are in the gig economy because they face racism in the workplace. And, you know, it really is a lot of people, you know, I pay tribute to a lot of people who've gone out on the airwaves and who've really had to talk about this. But, you know, we're tired and it's emotionally draining and we shouldn't have to, you know, very much. And I bring it back as well for, you know, more of your mm-hmm. audience to recognize that, you know, we do this as women.
Yeah.
We do this as black people. And it's tiring to have to mm-hmm. constantly justify the sexism, the racism mm-hmm. that we're facing.
What would you like to see? I mean, I would usually at this point ask, what would you like to see the government do here? But I think we know that there's not a lot they're going to do. What would you like to see the opposition do here? Oh, actually, can we have the opposition do something that is productive and useful?
Well, I would like to see, I mean, I've, you know, obviously We've seen people like Marsha Dakotova speak out, and other Black and Asian members of the opposition. And to be honest, I've been really heartened by the fact that many people have stepped up and spoken out against it. But I think, you know, we do need real, really firm commitments and swift denials of these things from the opposition. You know, we don't want to wait for it. We want racism to be placed up there as one of the key things that need to be tackled, and to see more suggestions and action for what can actually happen.
Yeah.
Because we know what the answers are. You know, we know what the answers are. We've had report after report after report, but this needs to be firmly embedded in policies going forward.
Yeah. Fonda, thank you so much for talking to us tonight and taking the time out of your evening. I really appreciate it. Fonda Wapaska there, the Executive Director of the Equality Trust.
That was Fonda Wapaska from the Equalities Trust talking about the race report. Now, my next guest is Hella Pick. She is a journalist, a nonagenarian. Is that the term for somebody in the 90s? I think it is. A nonagenarian. She has danced with JFK. She has had tea with Gorbachev. She's lived an amazing, incredible life. She talks to me about what she learnt about the world and herself.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
In her 96 years.
Hi, Hella.
Good evening. What a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for making time for us. You've written your new book, Invisible Walls, which is essentially about your life and the incredible career you've had, but also the beginnings of it and how you've experienced the world. I wanted to ask you to start with, why did you call it Invisible Walls?
Well, because this is a very personal book, and I have described the fact that I originally came from Austria, and I was one of the victims of Nazi persecution and came to England on a children's transport when I was just 8 years old, and then, of course, made my life in England. I had my education here and started work here and have more or less lived here ever since, except for many years when I was in America. But throughout this period, because you feel uprooted if you start your life as a refugee, I felt that I suffered all my life from certain insecurities which all my success failed to resolve. And that's why I call the book Invisible Walls. I feel I've somehow all my life been hemmed in, breaking out and finding true fulfillment as a result of having started life as a refugee. So there are my invisible walls. But I can't complain. It's been a good life all the same.
Oh, it's been an amazing life. Yeah. I mean, I think this is such an incredible piece of self-knowledge and self-awareness, right? To see those walls and know that that's what you've been pushing against. But can I ask you, what drew you to journalism and particularly to international reporting?
I fell into it. I think luck has played a great part in my life. I fell into journalism quite accidentally. I was looking for work, answered an advertisement and for a commercial editor for a magazine called West Africa. I got the job. It launched me into West African politics at a time when the colonial empire was breaking up and negotiating for its independence. And from then on, I just got so interested in international affairs. And this has remained with me ever since. I'm a dreadful news hound. I spent far too much time listening to news, reading newspapers, and so there you are. It's an affliction.
I love this idea that you sort of fell into it and you got a bit lucky, because I think so many of us sort of say that about our careers. My first job was as a commercial editor, so I don't know, which was a bit of a whim as well. But I think we say that about our careers, and yet there's a sort of a thread or something that draws us to them. So I'm wondering for you, you say you've been a news hound your whole life. What is it about the news that you find so fascinating, that you love so much?
Well, first of all, why I was so pleased when I got that first job is that I had realised I was not made for a 9-to-5 job. I had no joy because my very first job after I graduated was in market research. And, I had to be in the office at 9 in the morning and I'd be there till 5 o'clock. And yes, I learned a lot. And as it happened, I learned about West Africa, which is why I landed with that job afterwards. But for me, journalism was ideal because you have to organize your life yourself. You're not working for fixed hours. You probably work much harder than if you had an office job. But it's fun and it varies. It always changes. Every day is different.
You must have been at that time the only, or certainly one of very few, female foreign correspondents. Were you aware of that?
To start with, I was very much aware of it because when I was going out to West Africa, I was literally, I think, the only European woman journalist who was covering those rather obscure, well, not obscure events, but important events, but not in the main focus of attention. And I was surrounded by men. And, they were good to me once they realized that I was not foolish and stupid and that I was learning. They sort of, they took me in as a comrade. So, I really had a very privileged start as a woman journalist. But of course, once I started working for The Guardian, and I was at that point in New York at the United Nations, there were just a smattering of women there as well. But it was still, we were just a tiny minority still. And it was quite hard to be accepted as a professional. But at the same time, I've always maintained at that time, because there were so few women journalists, you stood out and people remembered you. And you actually often had easier access to people simply because they knew who you were.
I always said that I think that's a bit of an advantage, in that, if you've got 10 men sat around a boardroom table and there's only one woman, everyone will remember the one woman, sometimes for all the wrong reasons, but they will at least remember
her. Exactly, yes. And it's quite useful.
Well, was it useful for you? Because you have interviewed some incredible people. We're talking, world leaders at a time when the world was, I think, in one of its most chaotic states, your post-war, Cold War period, you are interviewing the people on either side of those Cold War. How do you get those interviews? And then what is it like to be in a room with people who literally hold half the world in their power?
Well, I think just to answer your last question first, it gives you a thrill, of course, but you also realise, these are people who have an interest in communicating with you because you are then going to write something and they hope that you will write something on the lines that they would like to see in the written word or the spoken word. But how to get to them? Well, I suppose, you start off small and then you come become a little bigger and people read you and they know who you are. And you have to win people's trust and their respect. And I've always, you know, worked on the principle that if people tell you something in confidence, you don't then go out and quote them literally, but you paraphrase and you convey the sense without actually betraying their trust. And I think so much of it depends on the way people regard you and what you write. It isn't just because you've got a pretty face. Mm. I don't think that's not necessary. It helps, no doubt, but it's not the most essential part of it. Many of my male colleagues, on many occasions, I would feel that they had much better access than I had. You know, it's quite a competitive field.
There's a bit in your book where you talk about how a request for coffee on board a Soviet ship led to a chat with Mikhail Gorbachev. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that was one of my more amusing experiences. This was in the Cold War days. Gradually, as the Cold War became a little less cold, there were a series of summit meetings between the Soviet leaders and the American presidents. And this was one occasion where Mikhail Gorbachev was meeting President Bush Sr. in Malta. That's where they had agreed to meet. Nobody had realized at the time, when they fixed the time of the meeting, that the season was a stormy season, the date that they'd fixed. Anyway, the Russians were clever enough, and they came in a regular boat and anchored it in the harbor of Malta. That the Americans thought it would be much more secure to be out at sea, and Bush was in a destroyer that was hovering near the harbour, but not in the harbour. The storms were heavy. Anyway, I was in a small group of journalists, we called it a pool of people, who were allowed onto the Soviet boat just to witness what was going to be the summit meeting between the two leaders. And we were sitting in the lobby of the ship and nothing was happening. And another colleague of mine and I, two of us, we two women, the only women in the group, said, oh God, if only we could have a cup of coffee. We saw a uniformed officer walking past us and we said, could we have some coffee while we wait? And he said to us, come with me. And we looked at him and he said, I'm the captain of the ship. And so anyway, he took us through corridors. We ended up in a very large reception room where there was a bar and a coffee machine and everything, and the room was quite empty. And somebody served us coffee, and suddenly Mr. Gorbachev walks in, then his foreign minister, the head of the army, an admiral. Anyway, it was, you know, a high-powered group, to put it mildly. And Mrs. Gorbachev appeared as well. And they saw us, and Gorbachev and Mrs. Gorbachev just sat down with us and chatted. And it turned out that Bush was unable to get onto the boat because of the heavy storms. And they were joking and said, shall we send a submarine for him? And then we discovered that the American ambassador was actually on the boat, but he'd been sequestered off into some room and wasn't allowed into this gathering. Anyway, this went on for about 45 minutes. And then they decided that Bush really wasn't going to get to this ship, and so they told us we'd better get off. So that was a memorable event. And the two leaders did meet the next day on dry land.
You've met all of these incredible history defining people. Who surprised you the most?
Surprised me the most? Well, in America, I would say President Johnson, for everything that he did to advance universal voting rights and really end the sort of deep segregation of the Deep South. So I think he turned out to be far more remarkable in the way he handled all those reforms than anyone had anticipated. And I think he's no longer underrated because some wonderful biographies have been written about him, which I think has really portrayed him the way he really was. In in the Cold War, or the closing stages of the Cold War, well, I think I would pick out Gorbachev, not because of our meeting in Malta, but because of the reforms that he initiated. And after all, it was the end of the Soviet Empire. He did recognize that the world had changed and that he had to change with it. And though he resisted it at first, he, in the end, understood that he had to accept the reunification of Germany, and that really was the end of the Cold War. So, well, Gorbachev, of course, is still alive, but I think he, I would say, just as Mrs. Thatcher admired him, I'm not the world's greatest admirer of Mrs. Thatcher, but she was absolutely right about Gorbachev when she said, "This is a man I can do business with."
You were a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, I think, for 30-plus years. Mm. What was it like to leave that?
It was hard. It was very hard. And at the time, I thought, this is the end. Now I'm going to be an old lady. And I was not prepared to be an old lady. And I was lucky, because after sort of weeping at myself and thinking the world had come to an end as far as I was concerned, I was asked to write a couple of books. Then I went to work for George Weidenfeld, the actual founder of the of Weidenfeld & Nixon, the publishers who have now published my book. And he started a think tank, which was concerned at the time with bridge building across countries, across cultures, and many things. And I, for several years, organized a Europe-China media exchange, which was great, very, very interesting, and got me to China, where I hadn't been before. And anyway, all sorts of new vistas opened for me, and I really had a very exciting and interesting time working with George Weinfeld, and forgot all about retiring and decided I never will retire.
I wanted to go back to where we started at the beginning of this interview, when I asked you about why Invisible Walls, and you talked about the legacy of being a refugee. Do you think that you have in any way come to terms with that legacy?
Well, yes and no. Mm. I think, of course, you have to come to terms with what happened to you. I've understood that this is something that isn't unique to me. It's something that I think most refugees feel. People deal with the problem differently, but somehow there's always something that is lacking. If you are uprooted from the culture that you were born into and the country you were born into, it never stops affecting you in some ways. I have to say that a friend of mine who has read my book, who is a psychiatrist, also believes that some of my insecurities stem from the fact that my parents were divorced and I never really got to know my father at all because he totally rejected me. So I've got an additional explanation for the invisible.
This psychiatrist finds reasons for everything. How did this sort of, I guess, this uprooting early on in your childhood go from Austria to the UK, but then also the reason you came from Austria to the UK is because you, your family are Jewish. So how do you identify yourself now? Do you think of yourself as Austrian, British, Jewish?
We all have several identities. Mm. You know, you don't just have one identity. I would say my dominant, twin dominant identities is, first of all, Europe. I mean, I feel I'm a European. Mm. And this is why I'm obviously not a Brexiteer. Yeah. And I still think that Britain made a great mistake. Mm-hmm. But for me, the cosmopolitan identity is important, the European identity. And the other identity, to which I came through long years of thinking and with considerable reluctance at first, is in the end my Jewish identity. As a child in England, and even as a young woman, I could not even admit to being Jewish, but that was quite obviously the result of what had happened to me. And it took me a very, very long time. And I must, I don't come from a religious background, so it is the Jewish culture that I consider my identity. And yes, I think Europe and Jewish are the two key identities. But of course, the British identity comes into it as well. But I think Brexit somehow has affected that concept of being fully integrated with Britain as the sort of absolute top of the pops as far as identity is concerned, because it alienates me, this rejection of Europe. It's I can talk about it endlessly, but I'm not going to bore you.
I think it's changed what it means to be British for a lot of people. Actually, I would count myself in that. Yeah, I think it's split identity for a lot of us, is what I would say about Brexit. There's an interesting thing here, which is you talked about, you know, identifying as European and coming to terms with the Jewish identity. How then do you feel, or did you feel, about Germany, and particularly, you know, kind of during that Cold War period? How do you reconcile your feelings about that?
Well, I've often asked myself where reason and where feeling comes into all of this, because I identified myself with Austria very easily after the end of the war, which in a way sounds absurd, but it's true. And with Germany, no, I didn't. Remember, I was asking questions endlessly, as so many other people did, about what did Germans do and so on. And then through my work, because I've been reporting, believe it or not, about the negotiations for Britain's membership of the European Economic Community, Britain going into Europe, and I have met Willy Brandt, who at that time was still foreign minister of Germany, because I used to speak in German and managed to infiltrate the German briefings at various meetings. And so anyway, he knew who I was. And then he became chancellor, and then The Guardian had its 150th anniversary celebration, and there was a huge dinner at the Dorchester Hotel, where the great and the good and perhaps the not so good were all invited. And Willy Brandt was the guest of honor. And there was some news story running that involved Germany, and The Guardian asked me to try and collar him after the dinner and get him to interview him. So I walked up to him after the dinner and said, can you have time for a few questions? And he said, no, not here. There are too many people. Come back to my hotel. And so me too didn't exist in those days, and I went back to the hotel, and as it happens, he just wanted to talk, and he had a suite, and I remember we sat on a sort of window bench and looked out onto Knightsbridge, and we talked about Germany and about his philosophy and his ideas, and it was all perfectly all right. Me too would not have been affected. And anyway, that conversation somehow turned my, completely converted me, if you like, to thinking differently about Germany. And from that time onwards, Germany, well, I was reporting quite a lot out of Germany, including the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, which was a very different place. But West Germany, then ultimately the United Germany, was to me, has become to me really a country that I enjoy. I have many friends there. It's one of the soundest democracies that we have in Europe today. They have a federal constitution that really works well. And,
now, for 15
years, it's probably had the best politician in Europe running the country. I've been to Berlin a lot and other parts of Germany, and I've come to understand the country, and totally reconciled to what happened. Well, not reconciled to the Holocaust, of course, but I mean, reconciled to Germany as a contemporary country that deserves to be highly valued as a democracy.
Hella, it's been so lovely talking to you. Just before we finish, can I ask you just quickly, writing this book now at the age of 96, looking back on your life, what would you want younger Hella to know? What would you tell your younger self?
About me? Well, I suppose I would want them to think of me as a journalist who did act as a kind of pioneer, who did establish the fact that, you know, women journalists, I mean, that helped to establish that women journalists were the equals of any man and women better. And I think also, you know, today, you know, well, as you know, I mean, the media are full of women, and, you know, I can't say that I personally recruited them, but I hope that by some small example, I've been able to show what it is to be a woman journalist and to be a good journalist. But, you know, I would, if I may just say that if you end up being a journalist like me, who spends, you know, half their life travelling because of the nature of their work, it can create havoc with your personal life, and it certainly did with my life. So, I mean, I would caution, you know, and I think many other journalists who had the kind of work that I did, we've all experienced that. It does create problems for personal relationship. You make a lot of friends, but whether you make permanent, loving relationships, that is the great challenge. And to be a good journalist at the same time.
I think that is a beautiful note to end on. Hella, thank you so much. It has been so lovely to talk to you. And your book is wonderful. Invisible Walls, which is A Journalist in Search of Her Life, is out now by the fabulous Hella Pick.
That was the awe-inspiring Hella Pick. That's all for this week's show, but I will be back next week with the normal format, you know, a bit of chat, an interview, a question, all of that stuff. You can, of course, in the meantime, listen back to over 100 amazing episodes and come and talk to me on social media. You can find me at Harriet Minter on all the socials. And if you liked this episode, please do rate, review, subscribe. It helps other people find us, and it's just a nice thing to see after a bank holiday. Take care.
You've been listening to Badass Women's Hour. If you like the show, then help more people find us. You can tag us or talk to us on social media using @BadassWomen'sHour. Or you can be really lovely and leave us a review and a rating. 5 stars, please. It helps boost us up the podcast rankings and allows other people to find us. We'll be back next week with more badass guests and in-depth chat.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.